Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Brad Lawrence.
TV and movies teach us that sex is a beautiful, wonderful, fun thing, when in fact, it is hard, sweaty work, and sometimes quite painful.
That, and you'll also hear Brad's wife, Cindy Freeman.
Hello there.
That's right. In a moment, I'm going to be handing the episode over to Cindy, who will be guest hosting. If you don't know, Brad and Cindy are essential on the Risk team. They handle the casting and the pitches. And over at thestorystudio.org, they teach so many of our corporate workshops. They are incredible. And for the longest time, I was encouraging Brad, hey, could we run your solo show, The Big Secret, as an episode of Risk? And finally, here it is. I'm so excited about it. It's a live show, and it's the whole episode, one long story, and it's really something. But before I go, I want to remind everyone that our 16th anniversary is coming up soon. So if you have stories about the number 16 in any way, or you are 16, or you remember something that happened when you were 16, or something that happened in 2016, whatever it is, long stories, short stories, silly stories, whatever, pitch us at risk-show.com/submissions.
We'll be right back.
All right, Cindy, take it away.
Great. Now, here's the show.
Afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun, day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one.
Doctor, everything will be alright.
Instead of asking how much of your time is left, ask him how much of your mind, baby. Cause in this life, things are much harder.
Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Cindy Freeman, and this is Prince behind me now. And we are calling this week's episode The Big Secret. It will be featuring one story, The Big Secret, by my husband, Brad Lawrence. Now, this is actually a solo show that he is currently on tour with at fringe festivals across America this summer. Next up in early August, he will be at the Minneapolis Fringe. The timing of this story being told now is not an accident. There are reasons which I think are going to become evident to you as you hear this story as to why Brad felt it needed to be shared right now. I know Kevin agreed when he saw Brad perform the show this past winter. His reaction was, let's get this on Risk. So I'm really glad that this is happening. This story was recorded this past February at Under St. Mark's Theater in the Lower East Side. They are run by Frigid New York, a wonderful independent nonprofit theater company. So, here we go. Here is my wonderful husband, Brad Lawrence, with The Big Secret.
As some of you have likely realized from the title of the show, at some point during this show, someone is going to tell me a big secret. And when that happens, I'm going to say, and then she told me her big secret. And then I'm not going to say what the secret is. And you're going to be like, oh, for God's sake, this is one of those art shows, they don't tell you what the secret is? No, I'm going to tell you what the secret is. But it's got to wait till the end. There are reasons. It's important. But before I can get into any of that, I've got to set some context. And in order to do that, I've got to take us back in time to 1986 to the Wednesday night meeting of the Evangelical Pentecostal Youth Group, of which I am a member. And this is not just any meeting of the Pentecostal Youth Group. This is a particular Wednesday night. It is the Wednesday night of our youth pastor, Augustus King's semi-annual sermon on the evils of premarital sex. This is the biggest event in the youth group calendar year. This is not held in the dingy upstairs attic room where youth group is normally held. No. For this, they've opened up gymnasium and turned off all the lights but for a single spotlight which shines down in a collapsible stage. And arrayed in the darkness in front of that collapsible stage is row upon row of fold-out chairs where we, the youth group ages 13 to 18, will gather in the darkness to hear Augustus King's semi-annual sermon on the evils of premarital sex. It begins this way. Augustus, a tall, thin, Ichabod Crane of a man, steps up onto that collapsible stage and into that single spotlight with a Bible in one hand and a beatific smile on his face with which he surveys his charges. And he begins by saying to us, TV and movies teach us that sex is a beautiful, wonderful, fun thing, when in fact, it is often difficult. It is hard, sweaty work, and sometimes quite painful. And with that, his wife, Gloria, sitting behind him on stage, smiles and nods. And from there, Augustus goes on to explain to us the reason the modern media, Sodom and Gomorrah, has been lying to us about the very nature of sex is because Satan himself has unleashed the demon lust upon us in an attempt to drag us off the path of righteousness, a path that would end up inevitably in the loving arms of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and onto the path of sin. And where does the path of sin wind up, you might ask? Augustus will tell you, it winds up at unwanted teenage pregnancy. And then once you have the unwanted teenage pregnancy, then MTV will personally advocate that you go out and have an abortion, and in your panic and desperation, you will do it. You will have that abortion. And then, if you have not gotten AIDS from all the sleeping around that brought about the pregnancy in the first place, then you will almost certainly get it from the needle as you turn to drugs to cope with the fact that you are now a baby murderer. And then you will die and go to hell. And once we have taken this in, that's when Augustus really goes in for the kill. Because that's when he explains to us that thinking about sex is just as much of a sin as having sex. Because when you are thinking about sex, that means you have turned over that still small place in your heart that should be reserved for the Lord Jesus Christ. You have turned it over to demon lust. And what could be a greater sin than that? So just being curious about these things, that is as damning as actually doing them. And only after we, the youth group, ages 13 to 18, all of us going through puberty, all of us very curious about what's happening in one another's pants, once we have taken on board that just that curiosity alone has very likely already doomed us to an eternity in a lake of fire, then and only then does Augustus finally throw out a lifeline. Because that's when he says, if any of you out here tonight have been harboring sinful thoughts or lustful desires in your heart, and you were to come down and lay those sins at the feet of our Lord Jesus Christ and be washed clean in his blood and his forgiveness, I want to invite you down here tonight, and I will come down and pray with each one of you in turn. And with that, 24 teenagers weeping all fling themselves at the foot of the stage, and I fling with them. And now we're all on our knees in front of the stage as Augustus comes down and begins to go amongst us, putting his hand on our shoulders and praying with each one of us in turn. And all around me in the darkness, these kids from the youth group, they're all on their knees, and they're all their heads bowed and their eyes closed tight, and they're weeping and praying to their sinful natures. And the entire time, I've got one eye open because I am desperately afraid that I do not believe as much in my own sinful nature as they believe in their sinful natures. And this terrifies me, because more than anything, I want to believe what these kids believe. And it may seem odd to want so much to believe in a God that wants to send you to hell for getting a little hot in the pants during Charlie's Angels. But what you have to realize is that I am a fat kid. I am a fat kid with Coke bottle glasses, acne braces, and a mullet I do not realize is optional. All right, I am not popular. I am not popular at school. I am not popular at home. I'm not popular at home alone. But Jesus can do something that no teacher, no guidance counselor, no principal can ever pull off. And that's that Jesus can make other kids be nice to you. These kids around me praying in the darkness, they invite me out to movie nights and for Chinese food and to roller skating nights. And sure, Jesus told them they had to, but they still do it. And certainly they still make fat jokes at my expense. But unlike the kids at school, their fat jokes do not end in name calling and a swing at my face. So even if it seems very strange to be so desperate to believe in a God that would seem to hate you, what you have to understand is that I am hanging out with kids my own age, and it is not ending in my blood or in my tears. So that God has already performed a miracle in my own life. So when Augustus gets to me and puts his hand on my shoulder, I bow my head and I close my eyes tight, and I vow right then and there that I am going to believe as much, if not more, than anyone else in the youth group. And real quick, about these other kids in the youth group, it should be said, they're kind of a motley bunch. I don't realize this. I think they're cool. But if I knew anything about what it actually took to be cool, I wouldn't be so far on the other end of the spectrum from it. But none of us go to the same school. We only see one another at youth group. And so none of us are really all that aware of what cliques we occupy at our respective schools or what status we have within those cliques. So at youth group, you can kind of be a version of yourself that you might wish you could be at school. Darren, he's a good example of this. Darren wears his Letterman jacket to every single youth group function. Big jock, baseball player. In reality, looking back on it, I realized that Darren was a painfully skinny kid with an enormous head and an even bigger mouth, and he never seemed to know when the joke had gone too far. Chances are, if anything, at school, Darren was more in the way of a baseball bench warmer. Or Adam. Adam was a musician, a trumpet player in the high school band, a low-status position. I'm sorry, band nerds, it's true. But at youth group, Adam was Augustus's brother-in-law. He was Gloria's little brother. And he never got tired of lording over the rest of us how much more godly he was than we were. Which is not a weird brag for a youth group, but it has no purchase at high school, not even in the band. Then there were the girls. Some of the girls were harder to get to know because they were so much more over-chaperoned than we were. Claire was an example of this. Claire, if we did a dinner and movie night, Claire could come to the dinner part, but the movie, not only could she not stay out that late, but Claire, alone in the dark with other kids going through puberty, her parents were not doing that. But then there are other girls like Julia. Julia was the one we all had a crush on. Blonde hair, brown eyes, a clear complexion, which none of the rest of us could boast. And we also kind of thought of Julia as the smart one, the bookish one, because she read books. And by books, we meant the Bible and books about the Bible. No sinful literature, mind you. But at some point, Julia started dating Adam. And this, of course, led to some makeout sessions, which then, of course, led to some over-the-clothes groping, which then led to hours upon hours of them praying for God to forgive them for their moral lapses. I heard about all of this because I was now occupying a strange place in youth group that I could never have occupied at school myself, and that was that at youth group, I was popular with girls, not in a fun way. Brad's so safe, we can tell him anything kind of way. And they did. That was how I found out that at some point, Adam's palm had brushed over a piece of sweater under which was a t-shirt, under which was a bra, under which somewhere was a nipple. These girls would just confess all these things to me and tell me all this personal stuff because I was safe. I was so far from being any kind of alpha male that I was no threat to them. But more important than that, more crucially, I think, was that I did not make any of these girls a threat to themselves. I was not going to elicit any kind of untoward thoughts or sinful fantasies they'd then have to pray about for hours. I was safe. They could tell me things and get a boy's perspective, and it would cost nothing of their immortal souls. And I do think these girls thought of us as friends. They were telling me all this personal stuff. But I don't think they knew anything about my personal life or my inner world. They didn't ask. And honestly, I don't think they thought I had one. Except Jessica. Right now, I'm going to tell you a little story that I think indicates the role that Jessica will someday come to play in my life. At some point, the entire youth group went out to a movie. The movie is called The Great Outdoors. It starred John Candy and Dan Aykroyd. It was a terrible movie. John Candy deserved better. Dan Aykroyd kind of got what he had coming. But at sort of the climax of this film, a bear has all the hair blown off of its ass with a shotgun. So the last thing you see of this trained bear is the bear running off into the woods, and someone from a props department had to garment tape to this bear's butt a plastic hairless bear's ass. All right, and that's what you see as it goes off into the wilderness. And this scene really captured Darren's attention because when he sees it, he has this little squeal and he goes, "Look at those cheeks!" And he turns and he looks at me and he grabs my face and he goes, "Look at those cheeks!" And this makes everyone in the youth group laugh, which inspires Darren to drive this joke into the ground. For the next 2.5 weeks, every time I see this kid, "Look at those cheeks!" He just comes up, grabs my face, "Look at those cheeks! Pinch me! Look at those cheeks!" Over and over and over again. And then finally, one night, we are at the Chinese restaurant we always go to, and dinner is over, and we're all just relaxing, sitting there, and Darren turns and looks at me, and he grabs my face, and he goes, "Look at those cheeks!" And Jessica, sitting to my right, goes, "I don't get it." And Darren says, what? And Jessica says, what's that from? And Darren goes, The Great Outdoors. And Jessica says, I don't remember that part. And Darren says, well, it wasn't actually in the movie. It was just kind of, she's like, yeah, I'm not getting it. Can you explain the joke to me? And now all eyes turn to Darren as Darren contemplates the task that has now been laid before him, which is this. He has to explain to Jessica, who is older than Darren and I. We're 14, she's 17, she's older, more sophisticated. She has long red curly hair, porcelain complexion, green eyes. She's very pretty. And she comes from this old, respected family in the church. And so now Darren has to explain to this person who is looking at him, just the picture of guileless innocence. He has to explain to her that the comparison he is trying to draw is between my face and a plastic hairless bear's ass. And you actually see him try. He kind of sort of tries to find his way into this problem. Of course, he takes a couple passes at it, and then he gives up. And he's like, oh, you know, it just actually wasn't, it's not really, it wasn't really that funny. Just don't worry about it. And then he gets up, and he moves quickly to the bathroom. And as he's going, I turn and look at Jessica. And Jessica looks at me, and she smiles, and she winks, and she reaches over, and she squeezes my arm. And no one ever touched me at that age. Except Jessica. And how we became friends? I mean, it's a nothing story. I mean, I said something funny at youth group one night. She laughed. We started talking, and then we just kind of slid into this natural, easy friendship. And that's what made it so weird. Because in any kind of normal reality, for me, socially, a girl like Jessica should have been so far beyond my reach. But for some reason, we just kind of slid into this friendship. We started gravitating to one another at youth group functions and hanging out and making one another laugh. And then she started offering me rides home from youth group events because she had a car and I didn't. And this brought about another ritual. And that was that when she'd drive me home, we would stop at this place near my subdivision called Fritz's Frozen Custard. I don't know if you've ever had frozen custard, but it's like ice cream, but better, and your life is sad. But we'd stop at Princess Rose and Custard, and then we would go to my pediatrician's office. It was closed. It just shared a parking lot with Princess Rose and Custard, and it had in front of it this lit gazebo that was lit up all times of night, and also this fountain that was never turned on. So we'd go sit under this gazebo on this dry fountain, and we would talk. And I'm certainly stopping for frozen custard 2-3 times a week was doing nothing for the acne or fat situation. But honestly, I think part of the reason we were able to form this easy, natural friendship was partly because I had no illusions this was going anywhere romantic. Certainly, I would have killed for a girl like Jessica to show me that kind of attention. But I knew better. And I think that little bit of nascent teenage self-awareness created this space for us to become real true friends. And that's what we were. We would go and talk about everything to one another. We'd talk about youth group gossip, a resource in which I was quite wealthy because all these girls were telling me all this crap. We would talk about things we were learning at church, the things that scared us, the end times, which we were being told were imminent and inevitable. We'd talk about our lives, we'd talk about school, we'd talk about our families. Like I said, Jessica came from an old, respected family in the church, but she also came from an old family. She was a late-in-life baby. And so she'd been born as adorable as an infant as she was as a teenager, and she'd been born into this world of adults staring down at her in awe and wonder. And this had engendered in her a kind of easy, natural charm. She had this natural confidence that created a kind of magnetism that drew people to her. And people just, they wanted her attention. They wanted her approval. Adults, kids, everybody just kind of, they were drawn to her. She was respected. She was, in our little faith community, honored. And I was the exact opposite. I did not come from an old respected family in the church. I came from a sprawling redneck shit show down in the Ozarks. We had moved up to St. Charles from the Ozarks when the mines closed, and my stepfather was put out of work. St. Charles is kind of a suburb of St. Louis. My natural father had died when I was 3 months old. He's a long-haul trucker, and he died on the job. And then my mom met my stepfather when I was 3 years old, and they got married. And when that happened, I went from being the youngest of two to the youngest of eight. And the mines closed down, and my stepfather dragged us up to St. Charles to look for work. And what he did, some of the older kids decided to stay behind in the Ozarks. Even though there was nothing to do down there, was no jobs, no industry, nothing going on, except for a new thing called methamphetamine. And that, they promptly started doing. And then they would show up at our house in St. Charles, randomly, unannounced, smelling of booze and weirder things, with strange people in tow, bikers, girls I now realize were likely truck stop prostitutes hanging out with the drugs. And they'd be looking for a place to crash or a handout or something they could steal. And my mother, being a good Christian woman, she felt some need to entertain all of this. My stepfather, however, he was a man of pure rage. He was an angry man. He'd been angry every minute of every day since I first met him when I was 3 years old. And initially, I thought it was because I existed. But I'm certain that his kids becoming a methamphetamine cartel did not do any favors for his mood either. But in the end, all of this chaos fractured my family. And at some point, we all started living like people occupying our own separate foxholes. None of us in it together. And so my home life was lonely and frightening. And my school life was lonely and frightening. And I couldn't tell any of the other kids at youth group about this. Except Jessica. I told her. Then one night, we're sitting on the fountain, we're eating our Fritz's frozen custard, when Jessica suddenly stops eating and she sits very upright. And she gets this strange, distant smile on her face, and she's looking at my pediatrician's office, the office door, but it's dark, there's no one in there. She's kind of looking through it, like 1,000 miles beyond it. And she says, in this small, distracted voice, she says, "I gotta tell you something." And I say, "All right, what is it?" And she says, "It's a secret. You can't tell anybody." And I say, "Okay, I won't tell anyone. What is it?" And then that little smile on her face crumbles, and she bursts into tears. And then she tells me her big secret. And it's big. And she is telling it to me through racking sobs. And it takes a very long time for her to get it all out. And the crying lasts longer than the words do. And when she finally stops talking, I, in a second rare moment of teenage self-awareness, say nothing. I just reach over and put my arm around her and let her finish crying it out. Eventually, when the tears come to an end and there's just sniffling, just drying her face, she turns and looks me in the eye for the first time during this entire ordeal, and she says, "This is a secret. You cannot tell anybody. You have to promise me you will never tell anyone." And I look her in the eye and I say, "I promise. I will never tell anyone." And then, a couple days later, we go back to youth group, and it's like none of this ever happened. It's like this entire revelation never occurred. Certainly, I can see that Jessica is carrying an added weight, and I know what that weight is from, but we just kind of go back to being Brad and Jessica. We just kind of go back to normal. No discussion. And that normal lasts for almost a year until that family of mine, the family I had told Jessica about, rears its ugly head. And the head that it chooses is that of Jeff. One day I come home to find that my older brother Jeff was in the house. He had shown up on our doorstep and my stepfather let him in, which we'd all regard as the first mistake. But when I got home, I was told that Jeff was going to be staying with us for an indeterminate amount of time. Information that I took in and immediately discarded as not important. Because Jeff was 35, I was 15, he had a wife and kids. Our lives had nothing in common. There was no reason for our twains to meet, as it were. So when I was told that Jeff's going to be staying with us for a while, I just filed that under not my problem until a couple weeks went by and I realized that it was very much my problem. And that came about because whatever Jeff's plan had been for getting his life together when he came to stay with us, it quickly devolved into permanently occupying the lazy boy in front of the TV, usually just in a pair of stained tidy whities. And when you are permanently occupying the lazy boy in front of the TV, that means you also have permanent control of the remote. And so now, all of my TV watching hours are at the mercy of someone on methamphetamine. And he watches TV like somebody on methamphetamine, just skipping from channel to channel, lasting like no more than 30 seconds on each thing, skipping past good shows, shows I want to watch, Manimal, The A-Team, Miami Vice, good stuff, and staying for slightly longer on things I don't care about, like wrestling and football games. But then he'll want to ask me questions about these things I've only seen like a minute of, and I'll be like, hey, what do you think of those Steelers? And I'm like, you were on the football game for 1 minute. I saw one Steeler. What possible opinion could I have on one Steeler? And it gets so annoying that eventually I stopped watching television. Which took care of the TV conversations that Jeff wanted to have. It did nothing for the other conversation that Jeff wanted to have. And that was the conversation he wanted to have every single day when I came home from school. At 3 o'clock, I'd walk in and Jeff would be there. If Jeff, at some point, had appointed himself my personal greeter, I guess because it was a job he could do without ever leaving the lazy boy. But I would walk in at 3 o'clock and every day, Jeff would be there. He'd ask me some variation on the same question. And that question was, hey, are you getting any? Where am I coming from? The ninth grade, not coming from a Coke orgy. I come from the ninth grade where I am still fat, still have glasses, still have braces, still have acne, still have the mullet. So no one is lining up to give me any of anything. And I have been taught at church that if they did, I should immediately run the other direction as fast as possible. But none of these are conversations I want to have with Jeff. And so when he says this, I just stare at him, unsure how to respond to this, and he takes my silence as a reason to ratchet up the intensity of the question. And so over the course of the next couple of months, it goes from, hey, are you getting any? To, are you getting any of that pussy? To, hey, let me smell your fingers. And by that time, I have come to hate Jeff. I despise Jeff. I loathe Jeff. The thing I want most in this world is Jeff, out of that lazy boy, and out of my house, and out of my life, forever. Then one day, I come home from school, and I walk in, and it looks like I'm getting a reprieve, because Jeff is not in the lazy boy. But then I see where he is. He's actually in the kitchen, hunched over something at the kitchen table. And this is kind of worse, because it's a hot day. I'd like a glass of water, and I'm also a fat kid. I'd probably like a snack. But if I go in there, I have to deal with him, and it's like, you know, but you know, at the same time, I can't be held hostage. I've got to be able to use my own kitchen, right? And so I'm like, all right, I'm going to go in there, and go right past him, and I'll look at him, acknowledge him, nothing. Go right to the faucet, get whatever I need, and then I'm going to get out of there just as quick as I can, and just like not even, just pretend he's not there. And so that's what I do. Up the stairs, into the kitchen, walk right past him, don't even look at him, and I'm at the faucet pouring a glass of water, when behind me I hear him say, hey, what do you think of that? And I turn around to find Jeff standing up now, holding open before me, spread out, a porn magazine. And this is no Playboy. There's nothing soft-focused or Vaseline-lensed about this. This is a skinny, strung-out girl in a motel room at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, gripping her labia with these three fingers, giving you an excellent view of her internal organs and the light from her nostrils. And he's holding this thing out to me. He's going, what do you think, huh? What do you think of that? And it's like, what do I think of what? My drug-addled stepbrother looking at porn at the kitchen table at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? That's obviously not the question. And he's like, what do you think, huh? What do you think of pussy? What do you think, huh? And what I think, I'm a 15-year-old boy. I think more than anything, I want to look at this naked girl. That's nature. But I've been taught at church that when I feel that desire, I should drop to my knees and pray for salvation, which I do not want to do in the kitchen with Jeff. So he's holding this thing out to me going, what do you think, huh? What do you think of pussy? What do you think of it, huh? What do you think of this girl? And finally, I break my paralysis and I shove past him and I leave the kitchen. I'm heading out of the kitchen and down the hallway when I hear him call up behind me, "What's the matter? You don't like girls?" And I get to my bedroom and I shut the door and I lock it and I sit down, and it is there on the edge of my bed that I come up with a plan that is elegant in its simplicity. And it is simply this, that when my mother gets home that night, I am going to rat Jeff out. Because I know nothing is more important to my mother than the safe delivery of my soul into the loving arms of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And she's not going to appreciate Jeff trying to lure me off that path with his porn and his questions. So that night, when I hear my mom come home, I leave my bedroom for the first time the entire evening, and I make a beeline for her. I go right to her, talk about the porn, talk about the questions, talk about all of it. And then I go back to my room, and I go to bed. And the next morning, I wake up, and I immediately go to church because Augustus has arranged an overnight trip with the entire youth group down to Apostle University, a Christian college administered by our church, accredited by Jesus. And he's arranged this trip so we can all go down and tour the campus, get an idea of what they have to offer, and it's going to be very exciting for all of us. And as we're all in the van heading down there, I am hoping to myself that what's going to happen while I'm gone is my mom and stepdaughter will get it together and confront Jeff and kick him out of the house. And that tomorrow, when we're coming back, I will be coming home to a Jeff-free house. And the next day, as we were driving home, we were all very excited. We've seen our future. Our future is here. It's obviously going to this Christian college. We're all going to go. We're all going to go. Because we can go to this Christian college and not be tempted by the sins of the outside world. And we can all go together. We'll all go together. It's going to be amazing. And we're all very excited about this. And this is what we're talking about as the van is pulling back into the church parking lot. And we're all looking out the window to see if our parents have shown up to pick us up yet. And I look out the window and see that my mom has not come to pick me up. It's actually my sister, Amy, is there to get me. But the church van pulls in and comes to a stop, and all the kids pile up. And we've been cooped up in this van for like 2 hours now, so we got a lot of energy, a lot of pent-up stuff, and we're just kind of, you know, horsing around and goofing off when Pastor Rex, the head pastor of the church, comes over to me and he says, "Brad, your sister Amy needs to speak to you right away." And I'm like, "Okay, no problem." And so I go over where Amy is standing on the side of the parking lot, far away from the other kids, and there on the edge of the parking lot, Amy tells me what I had wanted to have happen had happened. While I was gone, my mom, over my stepdaughter's protestations, had confronted Jeff and told him it was over and he had to go, and she kicked him out of the house. And Jeff's response to this, so he'd gone out, got in his car, and started driving south in the interstate towards the Ozarks, and about halfway there, he had crossed over the grassy median and into the oncoming traffic lane, the northbound lane, and aimed his car at an 18-wheeler. But the truck driver was not on meth, and he swerved out of the way, at which point Jeff enacted Plan B. And Plan B was he pulled over to the side of the road, got out of his car, opened the back door, and with traffic zooming by on the interstate and the traffic helicopter hovering overhead, he pulled out a shotgun, put it in his mouth, and blew his brains across the top of the car. And Jeff was dead. He had taken his own life. And I didn't know if any of the other kids had heard this or were aware of what was happening. And we didn't stay to find out. We didn't say goodbye or anything. Amy and I got in her car and we started driving south towards the Ozarks where my mom and stepfather already were, trying to figure out what arrangements they needed to make for Jeff. And then a few days later, we had a funeral. At the funeral, I saw Jeff's oldest daughter, and she was angry. I didn't know if she was angry at me, but it felt that way. And then we buried Jeff. And then it was time to go back to our lives in St. Charles. And for me, that meant going back to the youth group. And when I got back to the youth group, I arrived to find that a whole new controversy had erupted. And that was because Augustus, king, had decided that he wanted to have a tape and CD burning in the parking lot of the church where the kids from the youth group could bring their secular music and burn it in a barrel fire. And this had caused quite a stir. Not because anyone doubted the wisdom a bunch of 16-year-olds standing around an open barrel fire choking out the black smoke of burning plastic. No. The controversy was because no one could decide if U2 was a Christian band or a secular band. And this is a topic of much heated debate. And everyone was kind of trying to pick their sides and figure out, you know, where they were at on this big issue. And it would come up often. And one time it came up, and Jessica, she was also very involved in this. I think more she was concerned about the fate of her extensive Duran Duran CD collection, which was obviously doomed, than she was about Bono's fate. But when it comes up, she looks at me and she goes, "What do you think?" And what did I think? I mean, I guess if I was thinking anything about it, what I probably would have thought was, I was raised on TV and movies in the 70s and 80s, and from that you learn that only the bad guys burn books. But what I actually felt in that moment when she asked me was a sensation that it wouldn't be the last time I felt it, but it was kind of distinctly the first time I did. And that was a sensation you have when someone brings up something to you that is so trivial, so dumb, so beside the point, that all you can feel is tired. Because in light of what Jeff had done, in light of this very life and death, very much death thing that I had just had a direct role in, all of these little sins, the demon lust, MTV, Bono, all of it just seemed so small, so dumb. But these little sins, what bound these kids to one another, you know, having to navigate that narrow space, that narrow path that it takes to be a good Christian teenager and avoid all of these sinful things, that struggle was what bonded these kids to one another. And now, I was on the outside of that bond. So much so that I don't even remember how I answered Jessica that day. I don't even know if Augustus ever got to have his tape and CD burning. If he did, it was after I was gone. Because in short order, I stopped coming to youth group. And I stopped going to church. And when I stopped going to youth group and going to church, none of the other kids from youth group came around to find out what happened, to see where I went. They just let me go. Except Jessica. Jessica made several attempts to find out what had happened to me. But at 16, I just did not have the language to explain the loss of faith. And so, as I let my faith go, and as I let my God go, I also let her go. I would see her two more times. The first time was when I was 18, like 3 years later, and I have lost the weight and the acne and the braces, still had the glasses, probably still had the mullet. But I had met this girl named Susan. At long last, I was popular with a girl in the fun way. And Susan and I decided we should go to our town's 4th of July festival held in the Riverfront Landing every year. And so we headed down there and parked the car, and we crossed onto the parade grounds. And just off the sidewalk, there's a big crowd of people there, but I saw this gaggle of people who I kind of recognized a few of them, and among them was Jessica. And she saw me and she waved me over, and I started heading over to her. And as I was going, I realized, oh, that's why these people look familiar. Right, Jessica would have graduated from the youth group and into the singles group by this point. But she wouldn't stay there for long, because the first person she introduces me to when I get up to her is this guy with a mustache and glasses, who she says, his name is Steve, and he is a youth minister and her fiancé. And I shake his hand and introduce myself, and he seems very unimpressed to meet me, which is fine. And then Jessica and I make some awkward attempts at catching up, a little small talk, until finally, like, I feel like enough time has been put in that I can kind of make a head gesture meant to communicate that, you know, we should go and find Susan's friends who were coming down here to meet. And so we say our goodbyes and say it was good to see one another, you know. And then we we part ways. And as I'm walking away from Jessica, it does occur to me that, you know, in the church that we went to, kind of the highest level of respect that a woman could achieve was pastor's wife. And so I know that landing with this youth pastor, that must feel very safe for Jessica. And I genuinely am, I'm very happy for her. And that would not be the last time I saw Jessica, but it would be the last time I saw her alive.
Stick around for the conclusion of The Big Secret.
We'll be right back.
Okay, everyone, so look at the numbers from Q1, and you'll see that there's a sharp...
Alex? Oh, I think you're frozen.
And that's why it's crucial that we make...
Yeah, that sounded important.
Because if we don't act now...
We've lost him.
Bring an end to work call interruptions with EE Wi-Fi Enhancer. More work from homers are choosing EE Broadband, the UK's fastest growing broadband provider.
And he's back.
So I hope that was all clear.
To verify, see ee.co.uk/claims.
I'm Kristen Press.
And I'm Tobin Heath.
We're World Cup winners, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Every week, we sit down with the icons, disruptors, and game changers on the field and beyond it to talk victories, heartbreaks, and everything in between.
We've built a space where athletes, changemakers, and people creating the future of women's sports can show up and show off as their full, unapologetic selves.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
A couple of years ago, when I was 49, I called my sister Amy on the phone. And when she picked up, I said, I gotta tell you something. And Amy said, okay. And I said, it's a secret. And Amy said, okay. And I say, it's a secret Jessica Holmes told me. And Amy says, okay. And she said it that way because Amy knows the last time I saw Jessica, and that was at her funeral. I had stood over her open casket, staring down into it, wondering why they had put so much makeup on her, more makeup than you normally put on a corpse at a viewing. And Amy had come up behind me and looked over my shoulder and, intuiting what I was wondering, had said in a low voice that no one else could hear, sometimes, when someone is strangled to death, their face turns purple or even black. And so that is why they have put so much makeup on her. And so standing there at the age of 19 over my friend's casket, I learned something about strangulation that I had not known and would never forget. I'm not going to take you through the entire rigmarole, how they figured out what happened to Jessica. Suffice to say, you know how they always say that if they don't solve a murder in the first 48 hours, it'll never get solved? Jessica was the exception that proved the rule. It took them 3 years to figure out what happened to Jessica. What they finally figured out was this. Jessica, at some point, had become aware that her husband, now, Steve, the youth minister, had been abusing children in his congregation. And she had confronted him and told him she was going to call the cops, actually picked up the phone to do so, and he had taken the phone away from her and strangled her to death with the phone cord. And then he had staged the scene to make it look like a break-in. So when I say to Amy, I have a secret Jessica Holmes told me, Amy knows that I have been holding on to that secret for 3 decades at least. Before we go any further, I want to say something real quick, and that is this. I am not the kind of person who fetishizes death. All right? Jessica, not my first tragic death. We talked about my father died when I was 3 months old. We discussed Jeff. When Jeff died, I went from being the youngest of 8 to the youngest of 7. By the time I'm on the phone with Amy, I'm the youngest of 4 by attrition. And Amy is just 4 years off burying her husband. So what have I learned from a lifetime spent stacked knee-deep in the corpses of my loved ones? I have learned this. Someone else's death is not about you. It's not there to give you an identity. It's not there to give you meaning. And I say this because when I say I held on to Jessica's Secret for 30 years, the last thing I want you picturing in your head is that I created a shrine to this woman that I spent the next 3 decades moving from apartment to apartment, hiding in tiny little rooms and never letting my girlfriends go into. Right? I'm certain after her murder, keeping her secret felt like a sacred trust. I put it on a little pedestal in my head. But over the years, it came down off that pedestal. And I put it in a little box in the back of my brain that I never opened, never looked in. When her name came up, when the subject of her secret came up, I just never brought it up. Keeping that secret became habit. This became a thing I did, a way I moved through the world. But then, the Supreme Court did a thing. And now, I'm on the phone with Amy. And I'm saying to Amy, I don't even know if this is my story to tell. I don't know if I should tell this story. And so, I want to tell you the secret. And you tell me what you think. And Amy says, all right, go for it. And so, there, on the phone, for the first time in 35 years, I told someone Jessica's big secret. And it was this. When Jessica was 16, she got in her first summer job, working at a one-man accountant's office in a strip mall. She was a receptionist. And over a long summer of working with this 35-year-old married father, one thing led to another, and Jessica came up pregnant. And he wanted nothing to do with that. And so he paid for her to have an abortion in secret, and then he was gone, and she was left holding the bag. Now she had this thing she'd been through, and where could she turn with this thing? Where could she turn with the secret she had now? Her youth minister, the person who should be her counselor, Augustus, he of the semi-annual sermon on the evils of premarital sex, that doesn't seem likely, wrote this old respected family she had. When Jessica's murderer, Steve, went on trial, her father went to the sentencing and asked the judge to take the death penalty off the table because it conflicted with his pro-life convictions. Was she going to tell that man what she'd done? That seems impossible. Who could she tell? Who could she talk to?
The youth group missed it. The fat kid. Her friend. Me.
She told me.
And now, first time in 30 years I had told someone else, I told Amy. And I had chosen Amy because Amy grew up in the same church Jessica and I did. And she still goes to that church. And I knew that Amy would know how many nights Jessica had laid awake staring at the ceiling, thinking the worst possible things about herself with no one to turn to for solace. And now Amy is quiet on the phone for a painfully long time. And when she finally speaks, she says, okay, so you want to know if you can tell the story. Is that right? And I say, yeah. And she says, well, two things. She says, number one, I think it's very commendable you kept this secret for Jessica all these years. I respect you for that. That was very honorable of you to do that. I'm proud of you for doing that. But yes, I think you can tell the story. I think you should tell the story. I think it's an important story to tell. And she said, the second thing is more of a question. I said, okay. And she said, the question is, do you think that by the time she died, Jessica had time to realize that she was the victim in all of this? That she was not a terrible, horrible sinner? And now, it was my turn to be very quiet on the phone for a very long stretch of time. When I finally spoke, my brain had turned completely inside out. And what I said to Amy was, no, I don't think by the time, in between the telling me her secret and when she died, I don't think she had the time to turn around the aircraft carrier of guilt and shame's been dragging behind her all those years. And the other reason I think that is because I didn't realize it till you just said it. What had happened was I had kept Jessica's secret all those years exactly the way she had told it to me when I was 14 and she was 17. I had an affair. I got pregnant. I had an abortion. But that's not what happened. What happened was an adult coerced a child into a relationship she was not ready for. And when that relationship bore consequences,
He forced her to bear those consequences alone and in secret. All these years, I thought I'd been keeping Jessica's truth, and the only thing I was keeping was the lie she'd been told about herself. I thought I was keeping her memory alive. The only thing I was keeping alive was her shame, and it was a shame she never deserved. But I'd never opened that box and subjected that thing to the light of day in adult judgment. But now it was out. And Amy had just given me permission to tell this story. When I hung up the phone, honestly, I had more questions leaving the conversation than I had coming in. But over the course of the next couple of months, most of those questions condensed into one question that haunted me that I could not put aside. And that question was this: if Jessica had not been so desperate to get back into the good graces of her faith community and her God, if she'd not been carrying around this big secret, might she have seen something in Steve, some warning sign, that caused her to veer off the path that she was on? In short, if she hadn't been carrying around this big secret, would she still be alive today to tell her own story? And I had no idea how to answer that question. All I knew is that I knew what part of Jessica's story I was fuzziest on, and that was Steve's trial. By the time Steve went on trial, I had left St. Charles, moved into the city, and I got all of that secondhand from Amy. And so I decided to look into it. And so I went on the internet to see what I could find. And honestly, there's almost nothing. All this happened before the internet. All I could find, there were some articles behind paywalls in the archives of local newspapers. And these things are so old, they look like scanned copies of mimeographs. They're that old. But I did find one other thing. I found on a legal website, I found one page from one sentencing document about one piece of testimony and whether or not it could be submitted to the court during the sentencing phase. And all this was in legalese. All this was in language I really honestly didn't understand the implications of. I couldn't understand the decision they came to. But I scanning the page, I did come across one thing that was in plain layman's English. And that was the testimony in question. At this point, they were trying to submit to the court for the sentencing. And that testimony was this. While awaiting trial, the defendant, Steve, confided to a fellow inmate named John Conway that he was hostile towards the victim, Jessica, and he called her a murderer because she'd had an abortion. This is the power of secrets. This is the power of shame. It can turn a lie into the truth. It can make a murderer or a child molester believe he is a righteous man. A man so righteous he can sit in judgment of the very person he should be protecting most. So righteous he can mete out punishment to that person. But now the box is open and the truth is out there to be seen once and for all. And the truth is this: Steve was not a righteous man, he was a monster. And Jessica was not a murderer. And she was not a horrible, terrible sinner. Jessica was a girl. And she was a good person. She was someone who tried really hard to know what was right and to do what was right. She's a person of humor and compassion. And she was someone who was a friend to me when I needed that more than anything else. That's who she was. So in spite of the title of the show, I did not call you here tonight to tell you Jessica's big secret. I came here tonight to tell you Jessica's truth in the hopes that if you can carry that truth with you as I do with me, that maybe just a little bit, just by inches, we can move ourselves closer to a world where no one, where no teenage girl ever again has to live with a big secret. Thank you.
For Greg Carroll, this is One Tree Hill. We turn away to face the cold, enduring chill as the day.
I'm Cindy Freeman, of course, and we are hearing U2 in the background. But before U2, we heard Brad Lawrence's The Big Secret. You know, as he mentioned, he kept this secret for many, many years. But something he said early on with me when we first started dating, when we were talking about his loss of faith, was that based on experiences he had in his youth group, he at some point came to the conclusion that he was not interested in a God who had less compassion than he did. And that always has stuck with me. And now that I know this story, and I know it so well, I understand much more what he meant by that. Again, I think this is exactly the time to tell this story. With everything going on in the country right now in regards to women's reproductive rights and the overturn of Roe versus Wade, I just think it's important. I know a lot of people out there feel that when it comes to the pro-life, pro-choice argument, that it is simple and black and white. But when it comes to human beings, it is rarely simple, and real people are rarely black and white. But Brad said all of that so much more eloquently than I am even attempting to do, that really, in the end, I'm just really glad that he has chosen to share this story, and I'm really pleased that Kevin chose to put it on Risk. Brad is currently shopping a book-length version of The Big Secret to agents and publishers. So all you book agents and publishers out there, get in touch. Contact us at Risk. You can contact at brad@risk-show.com, or you can find Brad directly on Instagram at bradlaw77. That is B-R-A-D-L-A-W 77. And as I mentioned, he is performing The Big Secret at the Minneapolis Fringe Festival from August 2nd through 10th. Search for Brad Lawrence on their website, minnesotafringe.org, for tickets and for dates. One more thing, Brett also runs a really wonderful blog and newsletter called Go with Brad Lawrence, and that can be found using the URL bit.ly Go with Brad Lawrence. That's bit.ly/GoWithBradLawrence. So, one of our patrons, Coco Park, joined Patreon last year and wrote us a really lovely note that I want to read to you now. It says, Risk has provided me with years of guilty enjoyment. Not guilty as in guilty pleasure. Guilty as in I wasn't in the position to support financially. Now that I can, I've signed up to Patreon and will now have years of guilt-free feel-good listening. Thanks for all the entertainment over the years. Here's to many more. Thank you so much, Coco. We really enjoyed reading your note. So help support Risk and get a lot of great perks at patreon.com/risk. Speaking of casting, Halloween is creeping up. So yeah, send us your pitches of spooky, spine-tingling, scary stories. Stories that make you go eek. For more information, you can go to our website, risk-show.com, and check on our submission page. There you are going to find guidelines, all the info, and some honestly, truly amazing tips. We worked hard writing them. I'm very proud. Well, I'm about done here. So, you know, if you want to find me, you can. You can go on Instagram and search me out. I am at Cindy Freem. That is CYNDIFREEM as in man on Instagram. The next week, we are going to be listening along with Kevin to a story called Greg Fell Into a Crevasse. This is from the What Was That Like podcast. The host of that podcast will be joining Kevin, and we'll hear Kevin say,
"Oh my God, I think I'm drowning. I think this is it." And a part of me said, "Oh well, you idiot, of course you did this."
So yeah, come back next week and hear what all that is about. Until then, folks, today is the day. Take a risk. What is going on?